Since our kids are with us this morning, I'll just mention to the parents, so you can prepare. I will give them a recognition, even though there's not a note sheet. I will give them their candy like we do in the summer if they take notes. You may want to slip out, parents, and grab a note sheet off the Welcome Center, just the blank paper with pens if you need to, so that you have enough for our kids to make sure they're covered. I'll try to help the kids figure out what they need as we go here today. But if they can come with my main points and the main idea today and show me afterwards, they'll get their treat as recognition for their efforts at listening. It often does feel like everyone wants a piece of us, doesn't it? This week I did my taxes, and I was reminded that the IRS definitely wants a piece of me. There are times I remember from my corporate days where it felt like our employers wanted a piece of us, a greater and greater piece at times. It might be our parents, it might be our spouses, it might be our children who need more of us than they've been getting. School wants our time. Our friends want our time. Our hobbies, our interests want our time. The television set wants our time. My bed wants my time. Even the gym seems to want more of my time as I age. Just to do what the gym is supposed to do, it takes more time. The bottom line is that I'm sure you can all relate that we feel pretty spread thin throughout life. Yet over all of these various demands, and we could keep adding on to the list of things that consume our life, take up our time, over all of these demands, we know that there's God. God has demands on us as well. In fact, God demands all of us. How are we to balance all of these competing demands in our lives? We started working our way through the first letter that we have in our New Testament from the Apostle Paul to the Corinthian church nearly a year and a half ago. We've dipped into it and then went out of it several times as we've been interspersing our study of the book of 1 Corinthians with the first book of the Psalter, which is composed of the first 41 Psalms. The last time that we were in 1 Corinthians was before Thanksgiving. Some of you may have forgotten that we still had a chapter left. It's been so long since we were in 1 Corinthians, but 1 Corinthians has 16 chapters. We've only gone through 15. We do have one last chapter remaining, and all along I've intended to spend 2 weeks in this last chapter. But I intentionally moved these two final sermons of the study of Corinthians out to come at this point because I believe there'll be a useful lead-in to our missions emphasis Sunday that we have coming here in 2 weeks. I think these two sermons will help prepare us for that day. Paul was, by every measure you could possibly come up with, a successful missionary. Paul gave his life as a missionary. During his years of faithful service to the Lord, Paul saw the gospel message spread from Jerusalem all the way to Rome itself. And he was instrumental in starting churches in many of the major metropolitan regions within the Roman Empire. Paul worked hard for the gospel. Now Corinth, the city that is the focus of this letter of 1 Corinthians, was one of those cities. Paul, if you remember, had come to Corinth on his second missionary journey, and he had spent at that time 18 months of his life as an investment to see a fledgling church start in that very decadent city. We have the church in Corinth because Paul spent some time there. You may also recall that Paul wrote this letter that we call 1 Corinthians, during his third missionary journey, when Paul had based himself for about a 3-year time span in the city of Ephesus, which is in Asia Minor, what we now call Turkey. Paul had been away from Corinth for an extended period, but it's clear from this letter that the church of Corinth is still very much on his mind and very much a part of his heart. Even though he was not physically there, he cared greatly for them. Now, if you were with us through the study of the first 15 chapters, you'll remember that Paul has dealt with a number of problems that existed in this church. There were a lot of different things going on in this church. A lot of, as I said, Corinth was a very decadent city. A lot of that city was still part of the church, even though the people were being called out of the city to be the church in Corinth. There was a lot of Corinth in the church. Yet at the core, as we worked our way through these problems, at the core of many of these problems was an underlying matter of fierce individualism. Thoughts about individual freedom popped up over and over again as an underlying source of the various things that caused divisions within the church, that caused sinful behaviors within the church. This was a church that was filled with people who had their own thoughts about things. Even if those thoughts differed and clashed with what the apostle had communicated in his teaching, they held on individualism. Now, Paul has dealt with a lot of issues. At times, he had to use some rather harsh language in this letter. What isn't clear as Paul closes out the letter now is how the church will respond when they receive it. Will they accept his teaching, or will they, in that fierce individual spirit that they have, rebel against his teaching? There's a question mark there. Paul doesn't know what will happen. But we'll see, as he closes this letter, Paul assumes the best. These are children of God. They have placed their faith in Jesus Christ. They are now God's children, and Paul is going to assume the best, that God's word will work when they hear it. Paul is writing under the inspiration of the Spirit, and he's leaving it to the Spirit to bring about the change that needs to occur. So when he closes this letter, he assumes the best. He takes on an optimistic tone as he touches on several final matters. The final chapter is most distinctive in the sense that it's got a number of topics that are just briefly touched on. It reads very much like a letter between friends. Paul is writing to them as if they're friends, not as enemies, not as adversaries. These are friends, and they share a number of mutual interests, and they're briefly covered. Yet I'm certain that there's things for us to learn in these topics that they're briefly covered. I don't want to neglect these final verses. They're significant lessons that apply to our lives that we need to understand from the inspired apostle in the midst of all these details. Today, if you look in your bulletin, you can see that we're going to look at the first 12 verses. We'll cover half of the chapter this morning. And in these verses, Paul deals with four different items. But in these four items, he teaches three important principles. So children, there's three principles that you want to look for today that we'll be talking about. Three principles that can be summarized into one basic idea. So kids, you need to catch that one basic idea too. One idea and three principles is what I'm looking for in your notes. Adults, it's not bad if you catch those things too. Today, as we look at these, we can summarize all these principles in one basic idea. We must carefully plan how we use our lives. We must carefully plan how we use our lives. As I said, everyone seems to want a piece of us. There's no end to what will stretch us and cause us to go very thin in our lives. Yet our life is a life that God has given us. We're responsible to God. And as we're responsible to God, we must be intentionally purposeful and purposefully intentional how we use our lives. We must carefully plan how we use our lives. Let's read these 12 verses together. Remember, there's four sections here that will teach us three principles, all summarized by the idea that we must carefully plan how we use our lives. Paul writes, "Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the church of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper, so that no collections be made when I come. When I arrive, whomever you may appoint, I will send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. And if it is fitting for me to go also, they will go with me. But I will come to you after I go through Macedonia, for I am going through Macedonia, and perhaps I will stay with you, or even spend the winter, so that you may send me on my way wherever I may go. For I do not wish to see you just now in passing, for I hope to remain with you for some time, if the Lord permits. But I will remain in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective service is open to me, and there are many adversaries. Now if Timothy comes, see that he is with you without cause to be afraid, for he is doing the Lord's work, as I also am. So let no one despise him, but send him on his way in peace, so that he may come to me, him to be with the brethren. But concerning Apollos, our brother, I encouraged him greatly to come to you with the brethren. And it was not at all his desire to come now, but he will come when he has an opportunity. Four different sections there that give us different details, different things that are being dealt with. But they all are summarized by this idea that we must carefully plan how we use our lives. The first section is verses 1 through 4. And in that section, we see the principle that we must carefully plan how we use our finances. We must carefully plan how we use our finances. The topic that Paul is addressing in these verses is one of a financial gift that he's collecting for the church in Jerusalem. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on the details of this gift, but he mentions it in multiple places. We hear about it in Acts. He mentions it in his letter to the Romans. He mentions it in the second letter to the Corinthians. And if we put all of those things together, what's going on is apparently the Christians in Jerusalem are having a severe economic hardship. They're going through real financial problems. By this time, the non-Christian Jews in Jerusalem were becoming much more adversarial towards Christianity than they were at the very beginning of the church. They were becoming much more hostile. There had been, even at by this time, some level of persecution. And it seems like all of that has culminated in great financial oppression for many of the Christians that were still in the city of Jerusalem. These would be Jewish Christians, but because they were Christians, they were having troubles finding work in Jerusalem. They were being ostracized from their families that were not Christians. So that was all coming together to result in significant poverty for this church. In light of this, Paul has instigated a collection from all the various churches that he's founded over his three missionary journeys. He's founded churches throughout the region of what would now be Turkey and Greece. There's a number of churches and he's instigated this collection of a gift that he wants to provide for the poor back in Jerusalem. He desired that the Gentiles, these were primarily Gentile churches, non-Jews, He desired that they would recognize their spiritual indebtedness to the Jews in Jerusalem because the church came out of Jerusalem. That's where Christ, he was a Jew, their Messiah that they're looking to. So he wants to see the Gentiles recognize that they're indebted to the Jewish Christians and to show that indebtedness by giving financially to their needs. Paul also seems to hope that this gesture from Gentile Christians would be well received by the Jews, and that would unify the church. Remember, the church overall is still pretty young. I'm using church in the largest fashion, not the sense of the church in Corinth, but the church overall is fairly young. It's only been a few decades since Christ ascended and the church began. So the idea that Jews and Gentiles are to be integrated is still fairly new. Throughout their history, Jews and Gentiles were separate people. So this concept of bringing them together is fairly new. And Paul's hoping that this service of the Gentile church to the Jews in Jerusalem, Christian, that would unite the church overall through a tangible action. Anyway, that's the backstory of what's going on in these four verses. This collection is being taken up. And apparently the Corinthians had asked Paul a question about the gift. Remember, part of what Paul's responding to in this letter is a letter he received from the church in Corinth. So when we see the words "now concerning," we've seen that several times, that seemed to be Paul replying to something that they had asked him. And apparently they had asked him a question about how they should go about taking up this gift. Based on Paul's references there in the first verse to all the churches in Galatia, maybe they had their own ideas about what they should do. I don't know exactly. There's nothing in Paul's tone here that seems that he has to drastically correct their thinking. It's not that there's resistance. There seems to be an honest question. So Paul briefly replies. And in Paul's replies, there's a few things that I want to note through which we should be able to learn things that will help us carefully plan how to use our finances. We need to remember that our finances ultimately are a reflection of our life. We receive life from God. We spend a portion of that life to work, and in exchange, we receive compensation. So our finances are a representation of our life. We exchange a segment of our life for money. Money equates to life. First of all, notice that Paul instructs the Corinthians to take a portion of what they earn and set it aside for the gift. And they're to do this each week. It's clear that he wants them to do it weekly. He doesn't want them to wait until he arrives to pick up the money and then quickly collect it. They're to accumulate it weekly. They're not to plan some big, massive fundraising campaign that when Paul arrives will be the trigger and they'll have this great campaign and point to, we got the apostle here, we need to raise money now for him. They're to systematically collect the money each week prior to his arrival. Secondly, note that Paul does not specify an amount. There's no hint of a tithe here. There's certainly no hint of high-pressure arm-twisting. In fact, he says that each person is to give as he may prosper. He's not even calling on them to give sacrificially at this point. The word they use is there for prosper is a request to give out of their abundance. In their day and age, employment was not the way we think of it as a long-term commitment, by and large. For most of the people, work was not real steady, and they were paid either daily or weekly. So the idea that Paul is saying when he says, as he may prosper, is that when a person has a week where he comes that week and he has surplus at the end of it, he should set some aside as part of this gift. Now, we should remember that this is not an offering for their own church expense. This is a gift apart from other commitments they may have. Paul is calling on them to acknowledge God's generosity by giving of any abundance that God has provided. Thirdly, based on the way Paul refers to the first day of the week, he most likely is saying, although we can't be real dogmatic about this, but he most likely is saying that the collecting of this money should occur as part of their Sunday worship. That's what makes the first day of the week special. That's when they worship. It's not the payday in Rome. As I said, some were paid weekly, some were paid daily. But they do worship on the first day of the week. Paul doesn't seem to be telling them to keep a stash at home. He's not saying each week as you hit the first day of the week, figure out what you have left over from the previous week and stash it away. It seems like what he'd be suggesting is that they should give their money to the leaders of the church. This is a church-based project. It's not an individual-based project. It's something he's calling for the church in Corinth to do. And then fourthly, Paul is careful to explain here how the money will be accounted for as it's taken to Jerusalem. He says, you will select men from the church who will carry it. Of course, this ensures that there will be no question of mishandling of the funds on Paul's part if he does travel with money. It seems at this point that it's unclear in his mind if he'll actually travel with his gift to Jerusalem or go some other direction. We know the end of the story, he does travel with the gift back to Jerusalem, but that's a few months down the road for Paul at this point in his life. But having other men selected by the church taking the money, that ensures that there won't be any accusation of mishandling, but also allows for the men from this church to meet the Christians in Jerusalem. They will see these people. They will get to know them. They can bring a report back to the church. That will support his unifying goal. And yeah, I would say most significantly about this provision for how the money is going to be handled is the implication that Paul expects this gift to be substantial. He expects this to be such a gift that it is worth having several people take it all the way from Corinth to Jerusalem. It's going to be worthy of that. Now remember, these men also will not be carrying a paper check. They didn't have such a thing. They'll be carrying coinage. Probably gold coins or whatever, they can convert it to the highest value, but they'll be carrying coins. Jim Wesolowski took some of our missionary coins that had been wrapped by the missions committee into the bank this week. He came back and said, man, that's heavy. Well, they're going to carry coins, and Jerusalem is a long ways from Corinth, so it'll take several men to carry a substantial gift all that way. So the implication here is that he expects this to be a significant gift that they're making. Now, I think we should recognize from this example here that we must carefully plan how we use our finances. One of the easiest places for our sinful individualism to show itself is in the area of our money. We have so many things that we want. We also come to the end of a week physically tired from exchanging our life for that money, or at least I do. I expect I'm not alone. By the end of the week, I'm tired. And that tiredness even makes me think that this was my life that I gave for this money. It's easy to think of that money as our money. But it's God's money. And we must carefully plan how we use it. Are we using it to build and unify God's church? Are we using it to generously help others within the body of Christ for the sake of his name? Are we using it as if we really recognize that all of our money is a result of God's generous blessing upon us? Unfortunately, we live in a day in which highly visible campaigns are constantly calling for our money. Hour after hour, it seems like we're bombarded with emotional-laden appeals to give to some good cause. Yet it would seem that the pattern that we find in Scripture is not one of responding to emotion. It's one of careful planning. We are to be intentionally careful about how we use our money. We're to determine what God would have us give. And that determination is to be based on what would be an adequate representation of God's generous prospering in our lives. We're to think it through. And then we're to give that amount without any fanfare to the church for gospel work. Week in and week out, we're to simply give what God prospers us. There's nothing flashy about this. It's just our Christian duty. Of course, the church must be careful to maintain structured accountability over the funds. Our money is the Lord's money, whether it's in our personal possession at home or if it's in the church collectively. We need to be careful not to mishandle it, because mishandling is a way of damaging the cause of Christ. We better move on. There's more I could say, but time keeps moving, so we better move on too. We still have two more principles to consider. We must carefully plan how we use our lives. That begins with, first of all, carefully planning how we use our finances. Here from the first section. Now in verses 5 through 9, as well as in verse 12, I think we find another principle. We must carefully plan how we use our time. How we use our time. Money is a reflection of the life that God gave us, but we live our lives in time. We have 24 hours in each day. We have 7 days in each week, and so forth. We expend our lives in time. We are creatures of time. And as creatures of time, we must determine how we're going to utilize our time. What will we do with our time each day and each week? Now, having mentioned the trip to Jerusalem with money, Paul inserts here a section addressing the upcoming travel plans that he has for himself that pertains to coming back again to the city of Corinth. And then in verse 12, it looks like the Corinthians had apparently inquired about Apollos. Remember, Apollos was another teacher that had spent some time in Corinth. We know from Acts that he's in Ephesus around this time, and apparently they had inquired about Apollos returning in the letter when they sent that note to Paul. So both of these items are dealing with travel plans, and I think from them we can gain a few insights that should help us plan how we should be making use of our own time. Notice that it is clear that Paul has thought about specific actions that he plans to take. His plans are fairly detailed. He states that he intends to return to Corinth. He states that he intends this to be a substantial visit. He's not just going to come through quickly. He wants to stay there for a little while, possibly an entire winter. He states that he plans to travel to Corinth via Macedonia, which Corinth is in what is now the southern part of Greece. Macedonia is the northern part. So he's coming through a northern tour. He's going to travel through a tour that will take him through the churches that he established in that region of Macedonia on his way to coming back to Corinth. Paul is not just meandering through life. He's making specific plans. We should also note that Paul is well aware that his plans are subject to God's divine providence. Paul's plans includes words like perhaps, and I hope, and if the Lord permits. He knows that ultimately God is sovereign over all plans. So while Paul plans specific actions, he holds those plans loose enough that if God's sovereign plan changes it, he's not going to have a problem with God's adjustments. I believe most significantly, though, we should notice the underlying motivation that drives Paul's plans. His plans are driven by what he believes will be most strategic for the cause of Christ. What will be to the greatest advantage in advancing the gospel? That is what drives his plans. He is not traveling to Corinth at the moment because he says he has a wide door for effective service at the current time in Ephesus. He's currently dealing with a significant amount of opposition. He says there's many adversaries, but in the midst of all that opposition, he's having a great opportunity for the gospel to advance. There's a gospel advantage to Paul remaining in Ephesus for a while longer. So he recognizes that. That's a factor in his plan. There's also a gospel benefit for his traveling through Macedonia and to strengthen the churches there that he planted. There's gospel advantage to that. And then there's gospel advantage for him spending a significant amount of time in Corinth to strengthen this Corinthian church. Paul's entire strategy that he outlines in these verses is all built around what he understands would be most advantageous to the gospel's purpose. And he's balancing all these different gospel demands. Likewise, in the case of Apollos, in verse 12, Paul simply states that Apollos, our brother, would not be coming back to Corinth at the present time, even though Paul says he encouraged him to do so. Now, we don't have any information beyond this simple verse. We don't know exactly what's going on, but we do know from Acts and throughout even the references to Apollos in this letter that Apollos himself is fervently engaged in gospel ministry. He's a man who was committed and active to gospel work. Paul says when he has an opportunity to do so, he'll come back to Corinth, but not at the moment. So we can probably speculate that at the moment, Apollos is engaged in something that he considers more necessary to the cause of Christ than returning to Corinth. Again, I think we can see things here in these examples of Paul and Apollos that will give us insight today in how we should carefully plan the use of our time. Most importantly, our driving motivation should be the strategic gospel advantage. We should be spending our lives carefully using our time so that we are aiding the progress of the gospel. There's nothing more important in our life. That is why we have life. Now, that does not mean that we should all drop our current jobs and go to the mission field. Remember, I used the word strategic gospel advantage. It would not be strategic for all of us to quit work and try to go to the gospel or to the mission field. I expect that we recognize that God has not gifted all of us to be preachers and church planters. He has gifted some to be successful in that, but he's gifted many of us to be successful in careers so that we can convert our life into support of men who are gifted as gospel planters, missionaries. He's gifted others of us so that we will be able to support the gospel mission of this church in all kinds of capacities. The point is not that we should all do the same thing. The point is that we should all be driven by the same motivation. We should all be motivated by the forward advance of the gospel. we should be spending our lives strategically for that purpose. This is both an individual and a collective effort. It's collective in that no single person here is to do it all. And that should be a very refreshing idea to all of us. We do not have to take on the entire burden of advancing the gospel ourselves. Yet God does intend to use all of us. So there's an individual component here as well. God intends to use each of us. Each one of us needs to examine our lives and see how we are using our time to move the gospel forward. Say you're a person who's gifted in the business world, and you've determined that your gifts will most strategically move the gospel forward by supporting others who actually take the verbal message to a place where you cannot go. Well, let me ask you, do the people that you work beside all week long know that is why you're so diligently working your job? Do they know you're there because you're strategically spending your life to be able to support the gospel ministry through others? Do they know that is your heartbeat? That the reason that you get up each morning and come to the office is for the cause of Christ? Or do they think that you're simply working for the next promotion or the next assignment? Do they know that Christ is the beat of every moment in your life? All of us need to take a look at our lives and carefully plan how we are using our time. Are we intentionally including actions in both our long and short-term plans that will allow us to strengthen the church, to share Christ with others, to redeem the time that God has given us? Are we simply meandering through life, letting circumstances dictate our days rather than actively planning our days? Are we trusting God to adjust our plans as He sovereignly sees fit? Do we rejoice when God providentially alters our plans through some unexpected interruption, anticipating that means God has given us even greater gospel opportunities than we were able to see on our own? We must carefully plan how we use our lives. We must carefully plan how we use our time. That's the second principle that we find here in our verses. Now in verses 10 and 11, we find our third principle. We must carefully plan how we use our encouragement. I'll be frank, this may not be the most effective way to state the idea that I want you to see in these verses, but I couldn't come up with any better wording. So I'm sticking with, we must carefully plan how we use our encouragement. Paul's already mentioned back in chapter 4, verse 17, that he was sending Timothy. Timothy was one of his co-laborers, a younger man that Paul has mentored along the way. And Paul had mentioned that he was sending Timothy to Corinth. Since Paul's concluded that it's beneficial for him to remain in Ephesus at this time, he sent Timothy. He sent them to help them with a lot of the issues that they're having in the church. The language that Paul uses when he says here, now if Timothy comes, that does not mean that Paul has any doubt in his mind that Timothy will show up in Corinth. Rather, it's a way of expressing he doesn't know exactly when Timothy will come. He sent Timothy through that northern route. Timothy is going through Macedonia, making a quick visit through the churches there on his way to Corinth. This letter will arrive first. Paul is sending this letter by ship directly from Ephesus back to Corinth. So the letter will come first. Timothy will arrive sometime later after he finishes this longer route through Macedonia. So Paul's not doubting that Timothy will arrive, but he is somewhat concerned about what kind of welcome Timothy will receive when he does arrive. Timothy is coming as Paul's representative. He's doing the Lord's work, just as Paul is doing. Yet, as I mentioned, from what we've seen throughout this letter, there's some friction between Paul and this church this time because of some of the sinful things that have come into this church. Paul has had to address very directly some of these sinful actions. And some of that sin has resulted in negative attitude toward Paul. And Paul's concern in these couple verses here is that this segment of the church that is adversarial towards Paul may direct that hostility toward Timothy. In fact, they may be even more aggressive because they'll see Timothy is less authoritative than the apostle himself. So Paul admonishes the entire church to make sure that they receive Timothy well when he comes. He admonishes the entire church to make sure that as a church they enable Timothy to do that work that the Lord has for him to do within their midst. I think, again, in this very short example of a real-life situation of a man coming to visit the church, I think we can extract a principle that applies to our lives now. We must be intentionally careful that we encourage the people that God brings into our midst in his service. God brings different people into our midst that he is using for his purposes. And it's all too easy to thoughtlessly discourage when we should be encouraging. Take the situation here at Corinth. Even though the majority of the church was probably not hostile to Paul, all it would take is for the majority of the church to be the silent majority when a cutting remark was made toward Timothy or even towards Paul in Timothy's presence. If the majority was simply silent when a negative remark was made, Timothy could be discouraged in his efforts. Do we stand with those who are doing the Lord's work among us? Do we boldly resist those who are resisting them? Do we openly support those who are doing God's work? Do we show our support in encouraging actions? Paul tells the church to provide whatever support that Timothy might need as he completes his activities in Corinth and prepares to leave. That kind of support could take on countless forms. Yes, there could be financial support, but it could take on a lot of other forms too, like words of thanksgiving to Timothy, thanking him for his time and energy, lodging, meals, help even in making travel plans. How do you find the ship to go back to Ephesus? The people of Corinth know Corinth better than Timothy does. Maybe it's simply actively listening and with a receiving spirit as Timothy is teaching God's truth. And on, there's lots of things that the church can do to provide support for Timothy when he's ministering to them. There are many things that might be done, but all of them would be encouraging to this young minister of the gospel. And all of them are best accomplished when they're the result of careful planning. In just a couple weeks, we'll have two men and their wives visiting us. I'm looking forward to our Missions Emphasis Sunday when Gary and Edith Jones from the Philippines and Steve and Martha Anderson, who have spent their lives serving in Africa, when they're here. They're coming to report on their ministry efforts and to encourage us in the gospel. But we will have an opportunity to encourage them as well. They'll spend time with us, and as they spend time, we can encourage them. We should be planning now to be here for that day. Believe me, your simple presence is an encouragement. We should plan on listening carefully so that we can interact with what they say. That's always an encouragement to a speaker when the speaker actually knows that the person that he was speaking to was listening and heard and received and considered it. So we should plan on listening carefully so that we can encourage them that way. We should plan to thank them and to serve them. Encouragement may not directly cost us anything financially, but it does occur most readily when we are intentional about it, when we spend time planning how we can be encouraging. We must carefully plan how we use our lives. We must carefully plan how we use our encouragement. There's no denying that we can feel ourselves spread very thin at times. Life is filled with all these competing demands upon us. Yet competing demands are not necessarily conflicting demands. God is sovereign over all these demands. To balance these demands, we must use our lives carefully. We must find the balance that God expects us to find. And that means careful planning. We must plan how we will use our lives. Today we've seen three principles that summarize that simple idea. We must carefully plan how we use our finances. We must carefully plan how we use our time. We must carefully plan how we use our encouragement. We must carefully plan how we use our lives. Let's pray.